Welcome to Tips from the Server Room. This podcast is designed for all you systems admins, network specialists, or the guys and gals out there in the office who handles it all. Sit back, relax, grab a beverage, and enjoy Tips from the Server Room. Hey, welcome back, my friends, once again to Tips from the Server Room. This is episode number 81 for February the 24th, 2015. I'm your host, Jack, and I'm going to guide you through all these magical worlds of networks, switches, cables, fiber optics, servers, and all things connected. Folks, this show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast. If it's tech, it's here. Check out all the great tech shows at techpodcast.com. Also, remember, we're also syndicated now across stitcher.com. That's S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.com. You can download their free smartphone app today, and you can enjoy tech shows and also many, many other shows out there that are available for you concerning all kind of podcasts, all kind of different genres that you might want to listen to. So check that out today at stitcher.com. Folks, please check out my website if you have a minute or so, and that is at tipsfromtheserverroom.com, where you can comment on these shows. You can also leave me a voicemail, and I hope you do so. I do have a voice message, but I think we're going to get to that next week and not this week, unfortunate. But it is 724-701-0550. Once again, 724-701-0550. If you have any questions or ideas for future shows, you can simply email those to me at jackstechcorner@gmail.com, and also follow me on Twitter, and as at Technoman. That's T-E-C-H-N-O-M-A-N. Technoman. Folks, hopefully you got my message last week that I was kind of ill. That was a sickness. A friend of mine said, "Hey, Jack, I had that for 3 weeks." And I thought, 3 weeks? Oh my God. I thought I was going to not make it. I finally did go to the doctors. I got some antibiotics. I told you about that last week. And they did their trick. They got rid of the sickness. My eyes are no longer watering. I can actually read my show notes, do the show. And I thought, well, now's a great time. This Tuesday night, you know, I may have a few sniffles left, but I think I can pull this off, and we're going to produce a show for you this evening. The first thing I have for you here is a couple comments. And I said earlier, you can comment on these shows if you go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com and just click on the comment section and just leave me a comment. And it's nice to get responses back from you folks out there listening to the shows. I do appreciate that, as all podcasters do. I know I call a lot of shows. I call the Mike Smith Tech Show occasionally and give Mike some of my ideas. And Mike calls back and gives me some ideas. So that's the kind of stuff we want to do. We all want to pay it forward. So this question, actually, I don't know if it's a question, but I'm going to read through it. We'll kind of sort this out as we go along. It's from Jeff. Now, Jeff put this on my on the website, tipsfromserverroom.com, and he has three different items that he wants to run past me. So I figure I'll read these to you, and we'll talk about them as we go. First was, this is dealing with the licensing stuff we talked about a few shows ago about CALs, or client access licenses, and he made some phone calls. It says, "Jack, I contacted PC Mall, who is my licensing vendor for Microsoft. They confirmed that you have to have a CAL for any device that uses DNS or DHCP if you're using a Microsoft service or Microsoft server for these devices. Funny thing is that they also confirmed that my Windows Server 2003 CALs, which had software assurance, were converted from users to device licenses for Windows Server 2008. The cost difference is about $5 more each, but I will go ahead and buy 4 more device CALs, I guess, for his printers." Now, let's first talk about this thing. We really went in depth about CALs, about how to license your different gear and your equipment. Now, Microsoft, or at least PC Mall, is confirming that if your device uses either DNS, which the device by nature, if you have your DNS set up properly and your DNS is picking up everything on your network, then it is going to see that device when it comes on the network. So that is a definite truth. That will happen. And that's called dynamic DNS, right? If we're not static in our devices in, which I recommend, and we can probably do a whole show on this, but I truly recommend that you static your IP printers. If you have a power outage, if there's a recycle of that printer, if something, if you have to reboot your server, something that would cause that DHCP server to drop that IP address, that printer is going to pick up a new IP address, and then you got more work on your hands than what you want to deal with. We've dealt with that in the past. It happens, as careful as you can be. So what I did, we ended up going across our whole entire network, and we built a new spreadsheet, and we put our printers, just, you know, keep them on the same subnet, but keep them in a different octave, if that makes sense to you. So most of our network is, let's say, something like 10.16.1.2.3.4.5.6.7 is used for the computers, for the DHCP services. So what I did, we took our printers and we made them 10.16.100.1.2.3.4.5. We worked our way up. That gave us IP addresses, one, that's no longer in the scope of our DHCP server, and two, I knew that I was putting those static addresses out there that I wasn't going to use for my clients. So that helped me two ways. But you know what you want to do is, the big thing here, folks, is to create a spreadsheet. And if you have multiple people working on your network, if you have multiple, not let's say vendors, but if you have multiple technicians working on your network, this is the kind of information we have to share between all of us. And the reason is, my techs know, when my tech will go out and set up a network printer, they know to, first of all, open that spreadsheet up. Second of all, look for the next 10.16.100 address. Next, they know to ping the address to make sure it's not live somewhere in the network and somebody might not have put it in a spreadsheet, because that can be devastating. And then they would go ahead and set that printer up, give it the new address, and they would set that up and put that on a spreadsheet. You don't want to use DHCP. So does that mean, in this particular situation, does that mean then, if I'm not using DHCP, does it mean, under the understanding, that I don't need a device license because I use a static address? But if you think of dynamic DNS, they got you on the backside. Because your DNS server is going to pick up that host name of that printer, and it's going to pound it in there with your new IP address. So at that point, you need a CAL license. Now, will your device work without having a client access license? Absolutely, it will work just fine. Microsoft doesn't check and shut down those external devices. I don't know how they would be able to do that. But in the theory of things, and being under your licensing agreement with Microsoft, you know, you may want to investigate that. And I would say, like Jeff did, Jeff called PC Mall, I would say, call your vendor up and say, look, you know, should I do this, or would this make sense to do this? And if your vendor says, yes, it would, then you go ahead and purchase those. Like he said, he's going to buy four more cows for four more devices he has on the network. So that is something to think about. Now, his next question is, I use VMware ESXi servers. To back up a server, I clone the server to another data store. And then I run the free, it's called VM Backup, V-E-E-A-M Backup program, to copy it to a hard drive on my desktop PC at one time. At one time, I just used a clone option and kept copies on another data store. I have a lots of available storage space, and you can clone them while they are running. Just another way to get a full backup. Now, Jeff, this is absolutely extraordinary that you would send this in, and I really do appreciate this kind of feedback, folks, because I never heard of this backup software. It's free. V-E-E-A-M. I think it's pronounced VM Backup. And I'm going to look this up, actually. I didn't actually look this up when I first read this comment. But that's a very hard thing with us, is backing up our virtual machines, our VMs. This is huge. Now, this is huge because even if you have these on a NAS, a network attached storage device, and you're running, let's say, two physical boxes with ESX server, okay, not ESXi, the free one. Let's say you have the full vSphere server on, because what that's going to allow you to do is, if you've ever played with that, is it allows those servers, as long as you have your VM stored on a NAS system, network attached storage, if one physical box goes down and it can no longer, that server can no longer talk to that physical box to be put on your network, it will actually move itself. The VM can move itself then to the other physical box to then allow it to host it over its network cards to actually use that server and keep it up. And they claim, we use ESXi, so we don't have this feature right now. We're looking at implementing it in summer. But it explains to me, or the way it's been explained to me, is simply put that the server will never be unavailable. And at that point, if it's never unavailable, then your availability is 99.9% or greater. That's a bonus on your part. Our big thing with virtual machines over the past years, and it's the same as a physical server. And I know you guys don't always back up your physical servers. I know you're not taking images of those every night and storing that image off site somewhere. I know that's not happening because it's not real world. Real world is, we pray that our servers are 100%. Now, here's what I'm going to tell you about that. Is what we do on our aspect of our servers is we concentrate all of our energy and all of our resources to backing up the data coming out of those servers. So, and I'll tell you straight up, and they're not a sponsor of the show, we use Barracuda Backup Services. I've been using them now since before it was Barracuda. At one time, that company was called BitLeap. I don't know if anybody remembered that or not, but BitLeap was this little company I found. They were in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And being I'm out of Pennsylvania, I thought this is really cool to be able to find a local company to us anyway within the state. And when I first got this company and first started to talk to them on the phone, I think it was three or four guys that started this business. And it was one of the old like Google things. Their first server was kind of like a Legos. It was made out of bottle caps or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. It is on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and you look up BitLeap server, you can see their first server that they had in their first small office they had here in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Well, when I first started talking to these, I came home to my wife and I said, "Look, we need to get some money to either A, we need to invest it in this company. These are some up and coming people. These are some really smart people. Or we need to find money and ask them to buy the company from them." And within the next month, it turned out that Barracuda bought them. So one, I know I told my wife, I said we would never had enough money to touch them to buy them. That would have been just couldn't happen. I mean, and it was too late to buy in. I wished I would have known these people, about a year before I actually met them, because I would have bought into their company. This is how much I believe in them. Now, the way they do it is, and I'm sure a lot of backup companies are doing this, but they do it all the way down to the bit, okay? The actual bit of the backup. So what I mean by that is, if you have a Word document, normally most backup services, when you make a change, it makes a copy of that whole Word document once again on your backup. The way Barracuda is doing it now with the BitLeap technology is, when you're backing up a data, when you change a word in a document, let's say, for instance, if you change the header in your document, only that header will get backed up that night with the original document. That would be your revision. That's how granulated this company has been coming. And that's why I thought this is the company of the future for backup. Now, what I do like about them is it's relatively inexpensive to send your stuff off-site. But we don't back up our virtual machines because they're too large. Okay, that's what we're talking about here. So if I can run this program and take a copy and copy that to one of my other servers, even if I had copies of all my VMs, and Jeff doesn't say here if you can run this on a timed event, that would be very helpful, and be able to back this stuff up in the middle of the night. I think that would be huge, a huge benefit for all of us to be able to do that. Once again, that software is VEEAM Backup. So you might want to check that out. And I think you would be extremely happy. I know we're going to be playing with it at work and seeing if we can get it to work for us. Okay, so the next thing here is, can you do a show, the best practices of using organizational units in Windows Server and Active Directory? Now, Jeff, I've done a show. If you listen to some podcasts back, I've done a show. I think I actually have a YouTube video on setting up an organizational unit, OU. If you can look those up on my videos on YouTube, is 42 Technoman, the number 4, the number 2 Technoman. And I created a video sometime back on setting up an OU, the best practices of building that OU. And the best thing I could tell you now, how our OUs are set up, is the more, let's think how we can tell you this. The easiest way to explain this over a radio show here is, the more granulated you get with your OU, let's say that. So one time when I created an OU back with Windows, and it wasn't even called OUs then really, it was Windows NT like 4.0, when you're creating a structure of people. I built what was called basically a flat OU, and I did it in Windows Server 2000 when OU started coming about. We built what was called a flat one. Under users, all of our user count was under users. All the computers of the network was under computers. All the printers in the network was under printers. But now I like to get more granulated. I like to group things into certain areas. So in other words, if you have a finance department, if you're in education, maybe you have a teaching staff, maybe you have an administration staff. If you're in drafting, maybe you have the drafters, or in the computer business, you may have the networkers, you may have IT support, and many, many different fields. Create an OU for each one of those groups and put those users in there. And the reason I tell you that, or if you have an HR department, very important to put those folks in there, because sometimes these folks move around, right? People quit one job, leave your business. And when everybody's in a flat OU, it's just more complicated to dig them out, especially if you have thousands and thousands of users. A friend of mine took a job at PNC Bank. And PNC, I don't know if you're familiar with it where you live, but just think of a very large international banking company. And he said they have millions and millions of users in their Active Directory structure, millions of users. So having those people broke down into a more structured base is going to help you later find those people if you have to remove them, if you have to give them new privileges to certain folders. So that is under the organizational units on your servers in your Active Directory. And Jeff, you're right. I mean, we can go into this. I'll type a show up one night and we'll dig more into it and we'll try to talk more about it and learn a little bit more. And I'll try to put together some more YouTube videos for you folks out there that like to watch the videos. I know videos helps me a lot. I say if you know, words are worth, 100 words. If pictures worth 1,000 words, video is worth 1,000,000 words. Because I can show you stuff in the video. I get a little long-winded sometimes in my videos, but I believe, just like this radio show is, talking helps to bring about that base of knowledge that we want to share with each other. So, Jeff, really good questions. I really do appreciate it. Sorry it took us a little while to get them on the air. Sometimes, we get into other topics, but I felt this would really fit tonight really, really well. So this next one came from Brian. Brian says, "Hi, Jack, I love your podcast." I appreciate that, Brian. Thank you very much. "I passed my hour one-way commute by listening to your show." Now, his question is, the multiple NICs for RDP portion of the show caught my ear. We have a situation at work that I think could benefit from this. It's currently a physical box using dual NICs for redundancy, but it will soon be virtualized. I would have loved to see how this is done in more detail, but unfortunately you said your servers weren't cooperating. Do you think you'd be able to do a YouTube video or talk about it in more detail in a future show? Thanks again. Now, here is Brian. Great question from Brian here with multiple NICs in your servers. Whenever I'm going to virtualize a server, when I'm going to buy a new physical server, the one thing I kind of require in my physical servers is 4 NICs. And I understand you tell me you have 2, which is okay. At least you have 2 Some servers have the abilities to put another expansion card in them. You might have to look at your server. I don't know what kind of server you have. And you can add more network cards. And usually the expansion cards are not the typical NIC that we put in a workstation. It's a typical server card that goes in, and there may be 2 to 4 integrated NICs on one card. And they're a little smaller. They're not quite as high. And they slide in your expansion bay of your server. Now, why do I want to do that? Well, you know, Confucius says, or the people from VMware, and I go to conferences with these people all the time, and I meet with these people, and we talk about this stuff. One NIC will virtually, just like one processor, can virtually run 4 servers, 4 virtual servers just fine. They communicate perfectly over that one NIC. Everything seems to work. That is because of the integrational part of VMware, how they wrote their software, right? So they built this software knowing that we want to virtualize and we want to use the most out of our resources and get the biggest bang for our buck. So they wrote the software to allow that one processor to think that it's 4 processors, to allow that 8 gigs of memory to think that it's 32 gigs of memory because you can split it up amongst these virtual servers. And they also allow one NIC to transmit all the traffic for 4 separate servers using 4 different IP addresses. And if you ever looked at your VMware, go into the configuration module of the VMware and dig down a little bit in there, because what you're going to do is look for the networking configuration. What's in there you're going to find is virtual switches. And I believe you can have 20 virtual switches with 4 switching ports per switch going across one network card. Now, that's all well and good in theory, and it works very well. I've done it. So in practice, it's even very, very well to do that. But on the other hand, there's some days when I'm just old schooled. And the old school part of me says, look, Jack, if you can have one server on one NIC, it seems that the traffic would be less abundant, or there wouldn't be as much traffic coming through that one NIC, and things may flow just a little bit more freely. That's why I require my servers to have 4 NICs. I never put more than 4 virtual machines on one server. Again, just another personal choice. You can put 8, you can put 16. Until you run out of memory and until your processor is maxing out, when you're looking at your, you know, at your stats and you're looking at your waveforms for your usage of that machine, you can keep loading those virtual machines. But again, I believe in the, you know, they call it the user experience. So in the user experience, I believe when that person's using, if it's an application server, if they're using an application, if it's a web server, they're pulling up your websites, I believe this stuff should flow freely, it should be fast, and it should be very responsive. If you start loading these machines up with 8 servers, it's not going to be very fast and responsive anymore. Not going to happen. You're better off, instead of putting 8 machines, let's take a scenario. I want to put 8 virtual machines on 1 physical box, right? With, let's say we have a RAID 5 set up, or RAID 10. Let's just say RAID 5 to keep it simple. So let's say we have 6 to 8 hard drives in there running RAID 5. So everything's pretty safe. We're pretty sure that the data is going to be always good. And you're going to put 8 servers on there. You have 32 gigs of RAM in there. And let's say you have dual Xeon processors, or maybe if you have quad Xeon processors. I would rather take the money that I just spent for that $20,000 server and buy 2 $10,000 servers, cut all those resources in half, and put 4 and 4, 4 servers on 1 physical box, 4 servers on the other physical box, and I'm just more comfortable doing that. Each virtual server on the physical box will have its own NIC and its own IP address, and the traffic will flow. Do we use the virtual switching in VMware? Absolutely we do, because sometimes we'll bring up a virtual machine for testing. Sometimes we'll bring up a virtual machine to move from another machine. Maybe we want to start a new virtual machine such as now, we're doing this migration from our Windows 2003 servers. We've been building new virtual machines, 2012 servers, and I've been putting those on a virtual switch on that server until we can get that 2003 machine killed. Once I get it killed, then I'll take its physical NIC and I'll hook it to that server through the console. And it's relatively easy to do. It's not that difficult. So, Brian, I hope that this kind of helps you out a little bit. The RDP portion of the show, it caught your ear. You thought listening about the remote desktop portion of the show. And remote desktop is great. We've been using it for a lot of different applications. We've been finding that more and more vendors want their application running on the server. They don't really give you client software anymore. They don't want you installing client software on your workstations any longer. They want you to simply be able to run everything on the server, and you have everybody remoted in to do that. That goes back to the question we had in the beginning of the show there from Jeff about the licensing portion of it. When you're doing RDP, you have to remember to buy the remote desktop licenses. They used to be called terminal server CALs. They revamped it all that, and now it's called remote desktop CALs is what you need to buy. So once you get that and set it up, I mean, it works extremely well. But again, I would recommend if you're doing RDP, that's a lot of traffic over your network. And guys, I know I'm getting 100 emails about this saying, Jack, one network card is fine with VMware, and you're absolutely positively right. I agree with you 100%. But for me, if I have the resources and I have the money to buy it, I will buy the extra NICs and give that RDP. Not all the RDP sessions, don't get this, that I want everybody's remote desktop session to have a private NIC, but the server hosting my remote application will have its own NIC, and I'll allow all that traffic back and forth. That's a lot of traffic, right? Because you're transmitting that desktop back and forth to the client to have that on their screen. One client's changing screens from another client. They're all using the same app. It's just a lot of bandwidth, a lot of traffic going across that wire. So it's just something to think about. And why try to build yourself problems when we can build ourselves solutions so in the future we don't have a problem, right? That's what we're trying to do. And folks, if you're a network administrator and you can sit and watch the servers every day and you know exactly what the load is on your server and you know exactly what the usage is on your server, well, man, I tell you what, you have the best job in the world. Maybe you better marry it and never leave it. Because us, I even told my wife today, we have been so extremely busy. You know, there's two of us. We run about 1,000 devices on the network. You know, sometimes a little more with people bringing their own stuff in that we don't support, but we still have to supply bandwidth to that and make sure they have internet. But we have just been extremely busy with two of us working. We would never, ever have time just to sit and watch the resources on the server. That's not to say, if you remember a few shows back, go back and listen to the show. We talked about monitoring and reporting. Now that we do have set up where the servers will actually email us and say, look, something's wrong. We have an error here. Something's going down. And this summer we're working at putting a great amount of resources into network monitoring. So that's going to be the next big thing we're working on, trying to get this stuff monitored. So now tonight I was thinking about going into a lot of virtual server licensing concerns. And I think we're going to push that until next week. You know, like I said, I'm still working on my voice, but I wanted to get a good show out there for you. And these questions were a great way to bring you some really good information this evening and get everybody started here thinking about their virtual servers and thinking about, you know, new ways to do things with your virtual servers. So just really good, good stuff here, a lot of good information. And I hope that you really enjoyed that information this evening. Folks, I do want to bring to your attention very quickly here. Let me see here. First of all, if you want to support this show, and I know you do, I know you want to support this show, please remember to use my Amazon link. If you buy anything from Amazon, from cleaning products, waxes for your car, we're getting ready to clean our cars up, huh? Summer's coming soon. Spring was right around the corner. If you buy garden supplies, not just computer equipment, anything, I want you to use my Amazon link. Please go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com Just click on the Amazon link. You're going to pay the exact same price you normally do, and the show gets a small proceeds of that back to actually purchase new gear, pay for the website, and everything we need to do to support this show. Folks, if you want to learn more, no, let's strike that. Folks, if you want to learn everything about Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012 R2, or VMware ESXi Server, from install to administration. So you want to learn everything. You want to know it forward and backwards. You want to sign up for one of my courses at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Look for the online class link at the top of the page. Click on that. These courses are self-paced, very inexpensive. People often email me and say, Jack, if they're so inexpensive, they must not be any good. Well, the honest truth is, folks, I work full-time. I don't need to make $2,000 or $3,000 from each student. That's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to pay it forward to be able to make these, these courses to be top-notch, but to make them, you know, cost-efficient for everybody to take those, because I think everybody deserves to be able to get in the course and learn this stuff very inexpensively. That's why the courses are lower priced. One day, if I don't work, maybe they'll have to be $3,000. Matter of fact, one guy said, Jack, I would have paid you $2,000 for this course. I said, well, send me a check. He never did, but I threw it out there at him anyway. So, hey, they're self-paced. You watch a video. You take a 2 or 3 question quiz. Very easy to get through. Don't think, well, Jack, I've been in school for 27 years. I can't do that. You will be fine. I've never had anybody fail one of my courses ever in the history, and there's hundreds of people taking them all the time. Once again, sign up for that course. When you complete it, I will mail your certificate in the mail. You can sign up today at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Folks, I hope everybody has a great work week this week. It is great to be back on the air with you. And I know the show didn't reach the whole hour, so Jeff, I'm sorry, you're going to have to, or Brian, I think it was, said he listens to me in the car. You're going to invite us to take another podcast with you tomorrow here on the way to work, but we got you right around 35, 40 minutes. So I almost got you to work, and hopefully everything's going to work out for you today at work. Folks, thank you so much for joining me here, my friends, and I do enjoy you coming around and listening to these shows. Spread the word. Tell other people about this podcast, and I will talk to you next week. Don't forget to go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com and comment on these shows. Check you next week. Take care. I'll see you then.
You just listened to Tips from the Server Room with your host, Jack. If you have any questions, please drop me a comment at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Thanks again for tuning in and downloading the shows. Now sit back, relax, and listen to the remainder of the music. We'll see you next week on Tips from the Server Room. So long.